Table House. All right. My name is Jim. I am an alcoholic. Thank you, Pat, and thank you to the Love and Service Group for having me here tonight. I'll take these off and put them back on about six times. It's a nervous tick. I spent the past couple days in the car and in a hotel room with my 16-year-old daughter who's here with me tonight. And I actually joked with her during the sobriety countdown. I said, we can both stand up for 16 years because I've got 16 years sober. I said, we could, and she's like, no. And I was like, wait. You mean you can't stand up? And she said, no, I'm not going to. We've been looking at colleges the past couple of days, and I told her in the car on the way here that there were certain things that, there's certain things that my dad did when I was growing up. Coaching a baseball team, bringing home a paycheck, and bringing us to look at colleges. That if it weren't for this wonderful young lady and her two sisters, I wouldn't get to do these kinds of things. And their mom for trusting me near her children. So that's all good stuff. It's been a while since I've given a talk like this. I'm excited to do this. I'm nervous. I learned a little while ago that the physical reaction that I have that we call fear is really similar to the physical reaction I have that we call excitement. So I called a buddy of mine one time to 10 steps to what we do in AA. For those of you that are new, our 10 steps says that, you know, we continue to take personal inventory. We continue to look at ourselves and talk with somebody about that kind of thing. And I thought I was fearful about this new thing that was coming up in my life. And it was a good thing, but I was having these feelings. And I called an AA buddy, and he said, after listening for a couple of minutes, he said, are you sure you want to 10-step this? And I said, well, yeah. I mean, it's fear. I have to be honest with somebody about this. And he says, but this is a really good thing that's coming up, right? And I said, yeah, it's like great. And he said, is it possible it's just excitement? Do you really want to get rid of that? Like, and he gave me this new understanding of who I am and how I react in my life sometimes. And so I'm going to talk with you about whatever comes out tonight. But I can tell you this: a couple of things that I know. I've been continuously sober since February 13th of 2000, thanks to rooms full of people just like you. Thanks to a power in my life, I refer to as God, as kind of just a verbal shorthand. I cannot point to it. I can't really tell you about it. I can describe to you, and I hope to tonight, describe to you what that power has done with me and through me. I have not kept myself sober for 16 years. One thing that I learned early on in my sobriety by going through the first step with my sponsor, by looking at my drinking and my inability to control how much I drink once I start, and my inability to stay away from the first one based solely on willpower and a decision to not drink, and the fact that I just always drank right through that decision. One of the things that I came to understand there is that my sobriety is not to my credit. It's a gift that was given to me. I was talking with my sponsor a couple of years ago. There's this phrase in our basic text about the strange mental blank spots that can precede the first drink. And he said to me, he was talking about it and said something, and I said, yeah, well, I remember when I used to have those strange mental blank spots. He said, when you used to? What do you mean you used to? And I said, well, you know, and at this point I'd been a couple of years sober, and I said, well, I don't have those strange mental blank spots anymore. And he said, oh, well, let's test that theory. And I said, okay. And he said, let's get off the phone, and I want you to get a piece of paper, and I want you to write down the five craziest things you've ever done. And I said, do you want them ranked, like first crazy, second crazy, third crazy? Or he says, no, just get the top five. I said, okay. So I get off the phone, and I start thinking about, you know, driving that van up in Oswego when I was a fraternity brother up there in the middle of a snowstorm with a van full of people for a fraternity rush party, and I was not sober. That was on the list. And this tree house that we had growing up that we built on somebody else's property behind this restaurant, and they told us they were going to burn it down, or they were going to tear it down. We decided to burn it down because it was ours. We built it, so, you know, it's, we were 13. And then one of us got the great idea, why don't we stand on the top of it and then light it on fire and see who jumps off last, like chicken. Didn't have cable on the internet yet, you know, so what are you going to do? I had things like that on the list, and just about every one of them I was intoxicated for. And I have an intellectual arrogance. It still hasn't been put to bed entirely. Some days it doesn't seem like it's ever going to go away. And it leads me quite often to try to always be one step ahead of everybody else around me, and including my sponsor. I like to think, well, I know where he's going with this. I know why he asked me this. I make this list, and I'm going to call him up, and he's going to say, how many of them were you drunk for? And out of the five, it looks like four. And he's going to say, see, you know, how whatever. Whatever he's going to say, but I know it's going to be this finger-wagging kind of thing. So I call him up. I get the list done. I call him, and I said, and I hope while I've been telling you this story, you're making your own list in your head. You are? Yeah? Okay. So I call him up, and I said, I got the list. And he said, okay. And I said, do you want me to read it to you? He said, no. I said, then why did I make the list? He said, you made the list so you can look at that piece of paper while I ask you this question. Is taking a drink of alcohol on that list? Hadn't occurred to me. And he said, so you're several years sober now in Alcoholics Anonymous. You've been sitting in meetings of AA listening to people talk about the insanity in their lives, and you've been talking about the insanity in your life that alcohol has brought to you, to your family, to your employers, to your neighbors, college roommates, girlfriends, former wife. Is it safe to say that taking a drink of alcohol is the most insane thing you've ever done? He was right. And he said, and I gave you five chances. And it didn't occur to you. And you don't think you still have strange mental blank spots regarding your alcoholism? That set my butt on fire running for God. I don't know about you, but that reminded me that my alcoholism is it's here to stay. But I've discovered something else that also is here to stay, too, that seems to do a better job of taking care of that than I ever could. I'm going to talk about my drinking a little bit with you tonight. I think that's important that we do that. I am someone that I, just a drunkalog, I don't think is of much use in an AA meeting, because the new guys in the room, if they don't hear that there's some actual hope and some light at the end of the tunnel, other than the train they think is bearing down on them, I don't think that kind of a war story is of much help. But I also don't think just talking about the spiritual awakening that I had is going to help very much either. Because, if you were coming to my house and you'd never been to my house before and I gave you directions, let's say this is before GPS and smartphones and everything else. So I've given you directions, you're coming to my house, and on the way there, you get lost and you call me up and you say, I'm lost. And I say, well, where are you? That's the first question I have to ask you, right? Where are you? And you tell me, I'm at a Sunoco station. I said, okay, well, what road are you on? You say, well, I'm on Fifth Avenue. And I said, okay, is Sunoco station, okay, is there a Dunkin' Donuts across the street? And you say, no. And I'm thinking, oh, I know one, and I know another. And I said, is there a Starbucks next door? And you say, yeah. And all of a sudden, you're full of confidence that I can help guide you to where I am, because I am describing where you are. That's important. That's why we talk about our drinking in Alcoholics Anonymous, so that the new folks in the room can understand that we clean up nice. You know, we might look like, you know, we're happy, joyous, and free, because we are. And if you don't believe that I've been where you are, if you're new here, you're not going to have any faith that I might be able to help you get to where we are. So, my drinking started high school. Usual bush drinking upstate New York, outside of Albany, a little bit east of here, about the same north-south, right? straight shot across. And it was just fun, high school, bush drinking, not old enough to drink in bars yet or at the house parties with the older kids. So we get somebody's brother to buy us a 12-pack or a beer ball or whatever, and we go hang out in the woods and drink until we fell down. And it was fun. And most of the guys that I ran around with back then, I see them now, and they're grown, and they have families and jobs, and they're not alcoholics. And I don't know if I was at that point yet. I can remember really liking drinking from a very early age, but it wasn't until I was enrolled as a student at SUNY Oswego that I really started to experience the loss of control of how much I drank. And one example that comes to mind is St. Patrick's Day in 1985. I had a journalism midterm that afternoon at 2:20. Even remember what time it is. I remember now what time my journalism midterm was. Kind of see where this story's going, right? So I was, it was St. Patrick's Day. So they had, the bars were open at 9 a.m. and they had green beer. And from 9 to 10, it was 10 cents for a draft. And from 10 to 11, it was 20 cents for a draft. And from 11 to 12, et cetera, et cetera. So I got there at 9 a.m. Fiscally prudent decision making, I saw that as, and started drinking with some friends of mine. I think I had like $5 on me or something like that, and I figured I'm going to have half a dozen draft beers and get a dozen wings. And you know, back then in 1985, $5 would get you a dozen wings and half a dozen 10-cent beers. And then kind of let the chicken wings soak up that booze. You know, we tell ourselves that stuff, and then I'll go to my journalism midterm at 2:20. About 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I was with my buddy Randy, and we're cutting through the 24-hour study room of the library, laughing at people that are sitting in there studying on St. Patrick's Day. And I see this kid; he looks a little familiar, and he says, "Where were you?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Journalism midterm." And in our book, in the book that two copies were just handed out to these two gentlemen that have joined us here, there's a description in the doctor's opinion about alcoholics having an appointment, a business appointment that they're supposed to be at, that date's been set, and they have every intention to be there, and it's going to be settled favorably to them, some kind of business deal, but they take a drink a day or so prior, and the phenomenon of craving begins after that alcohol hits their body. And that next drink becomes paramount. And they lose sense of everything else. And that's what happened to me that day. And I didn't know that yet. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. But I understand now that that's what happened. The Chinese actually have a saying, the man takes a drink, and then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. That's my drinking in a nutshell. But I didn't know that yet. If you had asked me why did I did that, I was stupid, it was foolish, I wasn't thinking, I don't want to be a journalist anyways. I always had lots of excuses and reasons why the things happened that happened. But I was also, I was beginning to drink beyond my financial resources, and within, by the end of my second year, I had stolen several hundred dollars from the fraternity that I had had pledged, and I was the president of at that time, and I'm not a thief. Which it took me some time in AA to find this out. If you've committed theft and it bothers you and it's still eating at you, especially if you're new here, I'm here to tell you right now, if it bothers you, you're not really a thief, because a thief would just sleep well if that's who you really were. I am a man who has committed theft, but I am not a thief. And through the 12 steps of AA, I've been able to straighten that stuff out, and I'll probably get into a little bit of that tonight too. But I took this money out of the treasurer's dorm room, and then I felt so overwhelmed with guilt and shame that I had stolen from my own fraternity brothers, from the fraternity I was the president of, that instead of paying my tuition, which is what I stole the money for, because the money I earned over the summer, I had drank all that up, and I told my parents I was putting it in the bank, but I drank it all. And then I got my student loan, and I drank that, And so I needed money. They're going to kick me out of school. So I'd stolen this money, but I felt so guilty stealing from my fraternity brothers. I went immediately to the bar where I knew they'd all be hanging out, and I bought them drinks for a couple of days. Got to play the big shot, and then finally they the treasurer found out the money was missing, and all of a sudden people were like, yeah, Jim was playing big spender the other day. He's always broke. What's up with that? And it didn't take very long for it to come out that I was the one that had taken the money. So I left Oswego. My sponsor, actually, a few years ago, I said something about when I used to go to school in Oswego, and he said, you know, I've heard your story. You should stop saying you went to school there. You were might have been enrolled, but from the GPA that you described and the experience that you had there, you didn't go to, you drank in Oswego when you were supposed to be going to school. That's what you did, and he's right about that. But I left there, and I got into State University at Albany, which was closer to home. I was able to live with my parents. Our book talks about all the different things we try to do to control our drinking. And I can remember when I read that book by myself, and I need to tell you this. I have a master's degree now in literature. I've studied how to analyze the written word, and I could not read that book by myself, to myself, and make heads or tails of it. To this day, when I read it with another alcoholic, something in me wakes up that is able to see things that I can't see on my own. I didn't need an intellectual academic experience with that text. I needed to have a spiritual experience with that text, and I can't have that on my own. I need another alcoholic to have that. So a guy that was a roofer and painted houses for a living read that book and explained it to me. And one of the things that he pointed out was all these different things that alcoholics do to try to control their drinking when it starts to get out of control. And there's a phrase in there, accepting voluntary commitment in asylums. And I was like, well, I've never been in an asylum. And he said, well, an asylum is just a safe place. Have you ever voluntarily tried to lock yourself up in a safe place? And I was like, yeah, does mom and dad's house count? He's like, absolutely. I ran back home to mom and dad, and I would give my paychecks to my father. And I knew I was having some trouble. I didn't know exactly what was going on. I thought it was more financial trouble, because that's what I could see was, you know, I stole. And I'm having some financial problems, so let me give my dad the money, let him manage the money. But my drinking continued. And I was stealing from the store where I was working in the summertime, throwing beer out the back door and getting it after my shift was over. And just doing all kinds of goofy stuff that, I should tell you this too. I grew up in a family, I've got three sisters, and they watched the same TV shows as I did, and they ate the same food, and they were raised by the same parents, and they went through the same schools, and they're not alcoholic. I am. I can't hang my alcoholism on the hook of any external circumstance that made me an alcoholic. Now, I've talked to people who say that in their history they do believe that there was some cause, familial or genetic or otherwise, but I can only tell you my experience that I grew up in a family where alcoholism was not an active thing in my house, except for yours truly. So I, into my 20s, I managed to finish that degree. And when I got to my late 20s, I got engaged to a gal who got a degree from a really good school and got a really good job. And she was going to move about 2 hours south. And I scraped whatever couple of nickels I could get together and bought this little tiny chip of a diamond to put on her finger and asked her to marry me because I was like, wow, she's the one, especially, you know, with the nice apartment she had and nice car, and she liked to eat at nice restaurants, and I would say, no, let's go here, and she goes, no, let's go here, I'm buying, okay, and this opportunistic kind of thing that I had going on at that time, that I really liked the idea that my money and my paychecks and whatever I did bring in, that could be for my drinking, that could be for what I wanted to do. And she could pay the bills, and I had a job, I was working, but I just took advantage of her love and affection, and it wasn't the first time, and it wasn't the last. So in my late 20s, my sister Judy, my oldest sister, she got diagnosed with a tumor on her optic nerve, and had to go to Massachusetts Eye and Ear to have surgery. And my parents were going, and my dad said to me, we're going to Boston this weekend, and when you get out of work on Friday, meet us out there. We're going Friday morning. You get your butt out there. We're going to need you there this weekend. That's the kind of family I grew up in. I understood that was the appropriate place for me to be, and I was. I got in the car after work on Friday, and I drove there. And on Saturday, they were prepping her for surgery in the morning, and I'm sitting in this like family waiting area with my parents, and And I realized I was out of cigarettes, and I said to my dad, I'm out of smokes, I'm going to run across the street. And he said, just smoke one of mine, don't go anywhere. And I said, I'm just running across the street, I'll be right back. And he gave me this look, and he said, don't go. And I found out a little while later, he was afraid of exactly what ended up happening. He already had experience with me just disappearing for a day, for 3 days, just disappearing. I never really thought about the kind of torment that must have caused my parents until I had kids of my own. I can't imagine my daughter was missing for a day or two. I would just be out of my mind. So I said, no, I'll be right back. I'm going to run across the street. And I went across the street, and I came out of the store with a pack of cigarettes, laughing at my father for, you know, God, I'm going to get hit by a bus or something. And as I'm walking back across to the hospital, this thought occurs to me that I'm in Boston. And Cheers is in Boston. And I've never been to Cheers before. And my sister, who's having this surgery, she loves that show. And she's never been there either. And I bet they have, like, mugs or T-shirts or something. And I can't do her any good. But she's got surgeons taking care of her right now. This is the way my alcoholism always shows up. It is smart. It is smarter than me because it can use everything I know. And it never presents me. My alcoholism has never said, hey, let's go drink right now because your dad's expecting you to disappear. And let's break his heart. Never. My alcoholism, it's in me and of me. So anything I have at my disposal as far as the defense, it's already considered and knows the holes. It used my love for my sister, my desire to give her a nice gift, and some factual information. I've never been in Boston. Cheers has been. These are facts. I have a sponsor, by the way, that pointed out to me my ability, and some of you might have this ability too, to construct delusions out of actual facts. I can take real facts, and I can construct something that has nothing to do with reality. Walk in the house after work, and my wife's standing there in the kitchen, and I say hi, and she says, and I start, oh God, what did I do now? She's mad at me. She's not going to talk to me for a couple of days. I must have really screwed up. What did I do? And everything, and we're having dinner, and I start, you know, God, I can't remember what I did. So I finally, you know, and then I start getting angry because, you know, why is she holding a grudge like this? Obviously, it's probably something small. I can't even remember it, and she's like holding this grudge against me and everything else. And then finally, after supper or everything else, I'll have a moment alone with her, and I'll say, what did I do? And she's like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, when I came in, I said, hi, and you made this look. She said, I burped. Now, it's true. She went, you know, like that, but I take that fact, and I go, you know. So I go into Cheers, and I'm going to get a mug or a T-shirt or something like that. But I have a beer while I'm there because, you know, I'm in Cheers. And 2 o'clock in the morning, I get back to the hotel. And I didn't have my own room. I was crashing in a room with my parents. We had a cot brought in there, and I didn't have a key to the room. So I had to knock on the door. And I don't know if you've ever had to knock on a door where you stand there for like 5 minutes wondering, does a knock exist that is loud enough to wake them up but not so loud that it pisses them off? And then finally, they're already pissed, right? I just knocked. And if you have ever had the experience of hurting someone who loves you, that you love deeply because of your drinking, then I don't need to describe to you the look on my father's face, because you've seen it. It wasn't anger. It was just devastated hurt. My dad passed about 3 years before I got sober. And that convinced me that that boat sailed. The idea of ever making any kind of peace with that guy, just gone. Just gone. Because he's gone. And what could I possibly do about that now? I remember going, when he died of lung cancer, he was a young man, he was still in his mid-50s. And he was in the hospital for a while, and then they started hospice. And these folks, wonderful, kind folks, wanted to be available to my mom and my sisters and me. And all I could think of was, you don't know me, you don't know him, you don't know anything about us. And I was bitter and angry at them. And I remember that when my dad was admitted to the hospital, and I was still drinking at this time, and he was admitted, and my sister had called me and said, you know, Daddy's back in the hospital, and this is probably the last time. We don't think he's going to come home again. Can you come up? I was living a little bit south of Albany at the time. And I drove up, and I remember walking into the room, and the doctor walked in at the same time that I did and gave my dad the test results that the tumors that were on his lungs had spread to his spine and up into his brain, and that's why his vision was going, and they were through his glands and everything else. And they said, it's a matter of weeks, maybe a matter of days. We'll do everything we can to make you comfortable. And the doctor left, and my sister, who was always the information gatherer and talking with the doctor, she left with the doctor, and my mom went into the bathroom. I could hear her getting sick, and my dad's laying in the bed. And I didn't want to be in that room. I was scared. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. So I said to my dad, is there something I can do? And what I meant was, can I get you a drink of water? You know, so, can I get out of the room, please? Is there something I can do? And he said to me, you take care of the girls, Jim. And I changed the subject. I said, no. I mean, do you want a drink or something? Right? Same look on his face, disappointment and hurt. And he said, yeah, there's a Sprite thing out in the hall if you want to get me a little Sprite with some ice. Okay. And I went. And that moment, I knew what he was asking for. I have three sisters, my mom, and he wanted to know that I was going to be there for them. It's all he wanted from me. I couldn't give it to him. So I'm a couple years sober a little while later. Wait, let me quickly tell you about my bottom. It's really different than anybody else's bottom. I ran out of ways to drink. I ran out of ideas for how to not drink. In the summer of 99, I tried to, I had a girlfriend. My first marriage had already ended, and I had a girlfriend that I was trying to get her to let me move in with her because she had a house and she, you know, stuff. And she said, you know, she goes, I love you, and I think that what we have here is really becoming something really special, and maybe there is a real future here, but I'm worried about your drinking. And I said, my drinking? What do you mean my drinking? Like, I hardly ever drink around you. She said, yeah, I know, you just disappear for 3 or 4 days at a time. You're right, you don't drink around me very much because I don't like it when you do. She says, but if we're going to really pursue this, you'd have to go a little time without a drink. And I was like, well, why? And she's like, well, just to be sure you're not an alcoholic. It's the first time anybody ever said that word to me. I remember thinking, like, alcoholic? Like, park bench, you know, winos with brown paper bags. That's alcoholic. I've never been unemployed. I've never, like, that's not me. So I said, yeah, fine. How long are we talking about? Now, what would you think? I was thinking, like, you know, go 2 weekends, right? That'd be impressive, right? Don't drink for 2 weekends? You know, this was summertime. Go like 2 weekends in July. Go like 2 weeks, you know, without drinking or something. She said a year. And I remember like there was this thing in me, which I've since identified with, it's really connected in maybe even the heart of my spirit. It knows the truth. And it whispered to me, don't show fear. don't flinch. Don't. Like, and I was like, yeah, all right, fine, a year. What? Okay, sure. All right, no problem. And I went 6 weeks in the summer of 99 without a drink. No help, just I'm not drinking. And I had people during those 6 weeks come up to me that had known me for years saying, what the hell's going on with you? And I'd tell them, I'm not drinking. And they would say, maybe you should. Because, man, I was a high school English teacher. I was teaching summer school, which is lots of fun. And I'm not drinking. God save those kids, man. So here I am, 6 weeks in, and then a buddy of mine's getting married, and I end up going there, and I'm going to be the designated driver for a couple other friends that are going. It's just a bunch of guys. We're going to go together, and I ended up drinking there, of course. And then I tried to hide it for weeks and months and whatever. And I came up, and here's another thing that my alcoholism can do when it gets a hold of this mind that God has given me. I saw in a movie, I heard this character in a movie one time say, well, if you can do something once, you can do it twice. That makes sense, right? If you can do something once, you can do it twice. And I had, so I thought to myself, well, 6 weeks is a month and a half. So if you can do something once, you can do it twice. So if you can go a month and a half, you can go 3 months without a drink. And if you can do it once, you can do it twice. So if you can go 3 months, you can go 6 months. And if you can go 6 months, you can go a year. So I have proved in 6 weeks that I can go a year without drinking. Now, you're only laughing because that makes sense to you. Right? And you're just like, why didn't I think of that? But she was a math teacher, and I knew she was going to have trouble with her. So in February of 2000, I'll give you an idea how long I strung out this lie. And this, drinking, oh, I can't come over tonight, the dog is sick. I can't come tonight, I got to do laundry. I can't come over tonight, I got to do laundry. I thought you did laundry last night. Yeah, the dog got sick again, he threw up on the laundry. Weaving my lies together and, just a complicated life. God, I can't imagine having to have the bandwidth to keep track of the crap I used to have to keep track of. It's just amazing. So in February, I get home one day, and I'll give you an idea how I was living. It looked like someone had taken a dumpster of beer cans and pizza boxes, takeout containers, and emptied it in my living room. Dog hair, pizza boxes, beer cans, half-eaten pizzas in boxes. No one had been in my home probably since that previous summer. Blinds were drawn. I was going to school every day and teaching high school English. I'd take the clothes off the top of the pile. That smells good to me, kind of. Not realizing that I smell like the smell, so I can't smell the smell. And I come home one day, and there's a note from Darlene in the middle of all this. We need to talk. She had popped in. I remember being angry at her for doing that. Like, how dare she? Lying to her for months about my drinking. And my first reaction to getting caught is, how dare she? The best defense, right? Good offense. Get out there. Get out in front of it. And then I figured, then I got scared. I'm like, oh, man, it's the beer cans and everything else. But then I thought, there's so much garbage. The pizza boxes and the takeout. Maybe she didn't notice the beer cans. I mean, it's a mess. So I figured my only chance was a bluff, and I call her up, and she answered the phone. And I'm like, hey, what's up? I just saw someone laugh over here, and I know he did it before. I could tell by the way he laughed. And she said, what's up? You're drinking again. I said, what? Oh, the beer can. Oh, no. My friend Carl came over the other day, and he brought a 12-pack. I just haven't cleaned up yet. I know the place is a mess. I'm really sorry. If I had known you were coming, I'd baked a cake or whatever. I don't know. And I talked for like another minute, just kind of let me paint the picture for you. And I got all done, and she said, oh, I understand. So you're drinking and you're lying. We're done. And she hung up. And the next day, I decided I was going to do what was absolutely necessary to get her back. I was going to get up in the morning, get myself cleaned up, go to her house, tell her the truth. Yes, I've been drinking for the past 2 or 3 days. That's pretty good truth for at that point in my life. That's like 2 days more than I probably would have said the day before. And I'm going to do this, and I'm going to clean up this house, and I'm going to. She's right. I need to. There's something wrong with the drinking here. And as I'm hatching the plan of what I'm going to say to her, sitting on my living room floor, and I realize, I look down, I'm on my second beer. I don't know if you guys have ever found yourself drinking. Ever like decide you weren't going to drink and then not remember deciding to drink? You just find yourself drinking? I'll tell you right now, some of the defenses that you'll hear some members of AA suggest to you, like think it through. I don't know, guys. Remember the last drunk? Any defense against my alcoholism that depends upon the power of this thing, not interested. I'm not interested in it. If it works for you, I'm not saying you're wrong. If it works for you, do it. I'm saying I'm different. This thing doesn't work that way. It doesn't. I'll give you one more example of the way my brain works. That fiance that I had in my mid-20s, she, one morning I'm having coffee, she's having breakfast, and she's crying. And I said, why are you crying? We're getting ready to go to work. And she said, I miss you. I said, I'm right here. What are you talking about? You miss me. She says, no, like, it's been like a month since we've spent any kind of intimate time together. And I was like, what are you talking about? No, it was like just the other night. She's like, no, it's been a month. For like 4 weeks now, at least. You come home and you're drunk. You come home late drunk, or you come home with beer and you sit on the couch and you watch TV and you drink. And I go to bed, and sometimes you come to bed drunk and I know, and sometimes you just sleep on the couch all night. And she says, part of me doesn't even want to try anymore, but I really miss you. And I said, okay, why don't we go out tonight or something? Why don't we do something special? Because that's always my solution, right? Let me be flashy. And she said, no, just come home sober. Can you do that? I'll make dinner. Can you just come home sober? Sure. I had to teach that day, and I had a night class, a graduate class that evening. I get out of my graduate class. A couple of guys that I usually would go drinking with afterwards, they said, we're going over to Foley's, get a pitcher. Do you want to come? I said, no, going home. All day long, I'm thinking, I'm going home. I get in the car. They leave, no pressure. I get in the car. I put the key in the ignition. Here's what this thing does. This thing says to me, all right, we promised her we'd go home, so we're going to go home. So we're not going to go have a beer with our friends right now because she doesn't want us to drink. And, you know, those TV shows like Ricky Lake and Montel Williams and Jerry Springer and all that crap, like every time there's couples on those shows, I hated those shows, but I'd flip through the channels once in a while, and these couples would always be fighting and screaming, and it always seemed like one person was trying to control the other one. And I'm sitting in my car, and I'm thinking, she's trying to control me. Now, that's just the beginning of it. The next thought is, if I go home sober, if I go home without taking a drink, then I'm setting a precedent for a relationship that's not healthy. And then my next thought was, it is in the best interest of our pending marriage that I go have a beer. Now, I can't defend myself against what makes perfect goddamn sense at the time. I don't have any defense against that. So I went and I had a beer, and I got home at 1, 2, 3 in the morning. We never got married. She handed me that ring back a little while after that. If you've ever gotten into bed with someone that you love that you told me you'd come home at a time and you didn't, and the bed is shaking slightly because they're crying, and you know, don't touch them, just get in your side of the bed and go to sleep. That's what that was like. So, I'm at 9:15 here. All right.
So I bring all that to AA, right? And you guys stood up in front of me and you were like, "Hi, happy, joyous, and free." And I'm like, "I hate you." I could not stand some of the people that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous that were so happy and so at peace. But there was this one guy, Johnny W., Friday nights at the Kingston Original Group, he would sit at this end of this table. And I would always try to get there early, a few minutes early, and get a seat next to Johnny. And if you had asked me why at the time, when I was a week sober, a month sober, 3 months sober, why do you want to sit next to Johnny? I couldn't have told you. It felt good. It felt good to be near this man. I can tell you now what I believe to be true, is I was in the presence of someone who was aware of the presence of God. I was only aware of the presence of Johnny. That was enough. He was aware. I remember the second time I saw him, he said, "Hi, Jim." And I thought, "You remember my name. That's important here." Him and a couple other folks, they got me involved in that group. I had found myself drinking while I was making that plan to go see Darlene to straighten out that terrible debacle and everything. And when I called her, and instead of saying, I'm going to come over and talk with you, I know I'm on my second beer, I'm not going to talk to her now, but I called her anyways, and I said, "I'm in trouble, I don't know what to do." And she said, "Are you ready to do something about your drinking?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Call Steve." And I said, "Steve, you mean Liz's husband, Steve?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "I don't like that guy." She said, "I know. He's in AA." And Steve brought me to my first meeting. We would go out on double dates with him and his wife once in a while. And I would try to get him to drink with me. This is before, you know, before I knew anything. And every single time, he'd always say the same thing. Like, "Dude, do a shot with me. Come on, do a shot." He'd always say the same thing. "I'm not drinking today." And in the car on the way home, I would complain to Darlene, "You keep picking the wrong day for these double dates you're setting up. What day does he drink? We've tried Thursday, Friday, and let's try Monday Night Football. Maybe that'll work out." So I got involved with this group, and I had a literature commitment for the group. I thought that was a great fit for me because I was an English teacher, and I had the literature commitment. I thought that was very important sounding until I found out that my job was take the books out of the box and put them on the table. "You don't want me to analyze or critique?" "No, no. You'll do that your second year of sobriety like everybody else." just put them on the table. And then put them back in the box at the end of the meeting. And I would do that. And I would set them up. And I'd stand certain ones up. And I'd arrange some. And I'd make it look really... My house still looked like the way, you know, I'm like a month sober, 2 months sober, and I got this commitment. I still haven't cleaned my house yet, but boy, that table at that AA meeting, you'd think that I was like, you know, really particular about things. Yeah. But I found out, I don't believe that service will keep me sober. I don't believe that thinking better will keep me sober. I don't believe that writing inventory will keep me sober. I don't believe that. I don't believe there's anything that I can do to keep me sober, because I'm an alcoholic. If I've been trying to lay out for you my resume of handling my drinking, based on what I've described to you, would you hire me to keep me sober? Why would I hire me to keep me sober? It didn't make any sense. But fortunately, I met people in Alcoholics Anonymous that they were very kind and very, very patient. That intellectual arrogance, the alcoholic ego regenerates so quickly. I said, you know, "In your second year, you'll do that." Actually, my second month, I was critiquing stuff. Probably my second week. My friend Mary likes to say, an alcoholic should never hesitate to surrender all of their ego and pride. Just throw it all on the floor and walk away from it, because you know you'll make more tomorrow.
Don't worry about it. Just chuck it.
So I got a sponsor, and I did a, and he said that he would help me with the steps, and I did an autobiographical fourth step my first time, and it was this heart-wrenching, beautifully written. And I was the star of it. It was really something. It was impressive. I was so impressed with it. And I remember showing up at his house to do my fifth step, and the poor guy, his name's Clint, good man. And I walked in with this stack of paper, and he was like, "Oh, I forgot you're a writer. Oh, that's right. All right, yeah, start reading." And it wasn't a four-column resentment inventory. If you're new, that might not mean anything to you yet. Don't worry about it. There's people here that'll help you with that stuff. It wasn't a fear inventory. It wasn't a conduct. It wasn't any of the different inventories that our literature can really help us with. It was just me pouring out my guts on paper. And a lot of it was self-pity, and a lot of it was excuse-making and justification and all kinds of stuff. But there were a couple of things in there that I had never told another human being. It was the best I could do at the time, and it was good enough. I remember getting to this one paragraph. I won't share it with you guys here because it's not appropriate for this kind of a forum. I have shared this many times in listening to Fifth Steps with men when it was appropriate, when they had something similar. But I'm looking at this little paragraph. I was shocked I had written it down, that I had actually made a written record of this thing. And I remember, as I had been reading the other stuff, every once in a while he would interrupt me and make a comment or share something of his own. And I get to this part, and I think to myself, man, if he interrupts me, if I start to say this and he interrupts me, I won't be able to get started again. I got one shot. And I said to him, "Clint, this next part, I just got to get it out." And he goes, "Go for it." And I remember looking down, and I read it. I wasn't very loud. It was very fast. I just said it as quickly as I could. And then I couldn't look up, because I knew I was going to see that this was a guy I had come to love and trust. This was my sponsor. And I knew the look of disgust that I was going to see on his face. And I finally, it felt like a year, probably just a minute or so, I finally looked up, and he was smiling at me. If you have a sponsor in AA, you know that smile. If you don't have a sponsor in AA, you got to get to know that smile. Find someone that you can know and trust here. He smiled at me and he said, "I'm still here, Jimmy." I didn't know until he said that was the thing I needed most from another human being, that someone could know that thing about me and want to stay in the room and want to be with me. That's love and service. That's the deal here. There's a thing we say all the time. If there's a word for it, other people have done it, you know, that kind of stuff. But I can tell you, I've done other inventories since then, more by the book kind of things. And they've been incredibly helpful and freeing. But like I was saying, I don't think that stuff keeps me sober. What I do believe about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it clears away crap that has been plugging up the pipes between me and the power that I believe is here with us right now. And that's what the men that have sponsored me have told me, that this isn't about getting good. This isn't about getting right. This isn't about getting stronger. This is about getting honest about who we've been so that we can find out who we really are. I'm not a thief. I've committed theft. I'm not a liar, but I've told a couple of lies. I told you guys about them tonight. You've heard some of them. The way I know that I'm not those things is every time I've done things that are contrary to my spirit, there's a consequence. I pay a price. Other people pay prices. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has done is give me a way to walk back through all the messes that I made when I acted in ways contrary to my own nature and my own spirit and set those things right with. I'll tell you this story real quick, and then I gotta finish up here. So, making amends to different people, and I
I get to my dad on the list, and he's already dead and gone and buried, and how am I ever going to do that? And I had heard people talk about graveside amends and writing a letter and all this stuff. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and I said, you know, how do I write a letter? Where do I mail it? What do you do with something like that? And he said, why don't you just write down, if he were sitting in front of you right now, what would you say to him? And I said, okay. And I did that. And I went to his, I was visiting some friends in Massachusetts, and I was on my way back to Kingston, New York, and I was going to be coming down the thruway, and I was going to be passing by my hometown, and I figured I'd swing by on my way home. My mom still lives in that town. She's just a couple minutes away from the cemetery, and I went, and I read the stuff, and I sat there by his tombstone, and nothing happened, and I got to tell you, I was pissed off. I've had sponsorship that has told me that if you're not satisfied with the results that you're getting in your relationship with God, complain about it. There is a complaint department. It's open 24/7. You just let them have it. I've since learned that God doesn't care about my tone of voice or even the vocabulary that I use in those conversations. He's just glad we're talking. So I'm sitting there and I'm pissed off because nothing's different. I just had poured out all the stuff that time in Boston and countless other times, and stealing from him and my mother and the nights of worry, and stealing from my sisters and embarrassing him in our town, and like all the stuff that I had done. And my sponsor had taught me that when I go to make amends to people, I'm not allowed to say I'm sorry anymore when I have an amends to make. And the reason why, John had said to me, the people that you've hurt, have you told them before that you were sorry? And I said, yeah. He said, did you do it again? I said, yeah. And he said, did you tell them you're sorry again? I said, yeah. And then he did it again? Yeah. He says, so every time you say the word sorry to them, that brings all that back up. And you're going to hurt them again just by using those words. I said, then what do I say? You say this to them. I was wrong. I've mistreated you. And here are the things that I did that I think were harmful to you. And then you tell them what you did. Whether they know it or not, you tell them what you did. And then you say to them, would you please tell me what you need me to do to set the stuff right and balance these books? Because it's not my place to measure somebody else's pain. I don't know how deeply I hurt them. I only know what I did. And even that is clouded by my drinking. I don't even have an accurate memory of that. So another thing John taught me was, when you're all done telling them all the things that you did that you know of, you might want to say to them, is there anything else that I did I might not be aware of that we need to talk about? And you let them talk. And I've had amends conversations get significantly longer because my memory was not always the best. So I lay all this stuff out to my dad sitting there, and I ask him, what do you need me to do to get square with you, Dad? I need to get square. And I get nothing. And I get pissed off, and I get in the car, and I have this thought that I'm going to leave my mom a voicemail that I stop by the cemetery because she likes that, and it'll make her happy. So I'm about to call her, and I realize, well, I'm only a couple minutes away. Why don't I go leave a note on the door? She was out of town that weekend. I'll go leave a note on the door. It's 2 minutes out of my way, and it's a little more personal. It'll mean that I stop by the house. She'll like that. So I go over to the house, and my mom's sitting in the family room, and she's crying. The door's open, and I go in, and I said, what's going on? She said, oh, thank God you're here, and she's crying and hugging me and everything else, and she finally calms down enough to talk. She tells me her friend Paul, our old high school friend, had committed suicide the night before, and she just found out about it. And she says, I've been sitting here praying to your father to help me. And then she said, what are you doing here? I said, God sent me. Or Dad sent me. both, right? Because I knew that's what had happened. And we sat and we talked and we had a little lunch. And that was nice. But I'm still not square with the guy. I know it. And I get in the car and I'm driving home. And I start praying. I'm asking my dad, can you give me some idea how I can get square with you? And I'm asking God of my understanding, what can I do? I need to get this weight off of me. I need to know that I've got peace between me and my dad. And what comes up in my memory is that day in the hospital and me saying to him, is there anything I can do? And he told me, take care. care of the girls, Jim. When that memory started coming up, I didn't remember that part of the conversation. I remembered the shame and the embarrassment of it and knowing how badly I was letting him down. But then all of a sudden it occurred to me, he's telling me right now, I got three sisters and my mom. If I'll do everything I can for the rest of my days to take care of them. And I got to tell you, I have three powerful sisters. They don't need me to take care of them. I don't think any woman needs a man to take care of them. They let me sometimes do things for them. And that's what he meant, because that's what he did. He raised three powerful women. And he wanted to make sure that somebody was still there to give help when they wanted, when they asked for it, when they needed it. And I've been able to do that kind of stuff for my sisters. Since then, I'm married now, and I've got three daughters. Every once in a while, I say, really, Dad? Any more? But I got to tell you something that was on the other side of that memory, of that embarrassing, painful moment with my dad. In the days right before he passed away, they had him on morphine. And I'd forgotten all of this. Because of the painful experience that I had with changing that subject in that conversation, I couldn't remember anything beyond that. It just hurt too much. So I blocked this whole experience of my dad being in the hospital when he was dying of cancer. But once I had addressed that and I gotten honest about that, it opened up the rest of my memory. And a few nights before my dad died, he was on a morphine drip. He was 57 years old. He looked like he was about 90. Radiation and chemo had taken all of his hair. He was down to about 90 pounds, skin and bones, in a hospital gown, laying in this bed, eyes sunken in, face sunken in. Did not look like my father at all. And at night, I would tell my mom and my sisters, you go home, go back to the house, I'll stay here with him. And the truth is, I stayed there so I could run out to the car and drink all night. But here's another piece of truth. Every once in a while, even in his final days, he would stir out of this morphine-induced coma, and he would mumble, I want to get up, I want to get up. And if he did that during the day, the orderlies, my mom would get the orderlies or the nurses or whatever, they come in, and I love these people, the dignity that they gave my father, that even those final wishes, they honored those. And they would sit him up, and they would swing his legs gently, and they would support him on either side, and they'd put his bare feet on the floor, and they'd help him stand for about 2 seconds until his knees buckled, and they'd put him back in the bed. And my mom made me swear to her when she went home at night, if he wants to get up in the middle of the night, you don't do that. You get someone to help you. We can't afford for him to fall and break a bone. He doesn't need any more pain right now. Promise me. And I promised her, and I broke that promise. I got him up one night. I had forgotten about this. If it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous and the path you guys walked me down, I never would have been able to get back to this memory. He stirs, and he says, I want to get up. And I swing his legs to the side, and I put his arms around me with the IV tubes and everything else, and I put my arms around his waist, and I pull him toward me, and his feet hit the floor, and he stands up, and in the 2 seconds he's standing there, he does this. Good boy, Jimmy. That's available here. Those of you that are new to Alcoholics Anonymous, those of you that have been here for a while, that's available here. There is nothing too dark and too deep that you have done. There's no harm too great. There's no mess you've made. And with the help of your fellow alcoholics and power and love working through this fellowship and through you, it's available here. It's not about not drinking. It's about getting so free. Here's what it's about. My sponsor, John, the first time I ever talked to this guy, somebody introduced me to him, and he turned around and looked at me, and he said, you remember what two shots of whiskey did for you? I was surprised at that question. We're in an AA meeting, like after an AA meeting. I was like, yeah. He says, you remember the peace that would come over you? You remember how it would go down, and like that knot in your chest would dissolve? You remember that noise in your head would quiet down, and you could think? And you could breathe. Remember how booze used to do that for you? I was like, yeah.
he said, I wake up that way now without booze. You interested in that? If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's our question for you. We're not telling you that we're going to give you something different. The peace and the freedom that booze gave you. That's why we chased it, right? That stuff available without alcohol right here and now. Thanks, everybody.